Welcome to this episode of Akram Life Hacks. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Moody, a practicing rural generalist in Queensland. Akram acknowledges the Australian Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people as the first inhabitants of the nation. We respect the traditional owners of lands across Australia in which our members and staff work and live, and pay respect to their elders past, present and future. Today, I'm joining you from Yagara and Turrbal country. Welcome back. In our most recent podcast, we had a conversation with two rural health consumers, Carolyn Becker and Deb Robbins, to seek their point of view on the delivery of rural and remote healthcare, including experiences they've had from the other side of the consultation desk. Today, we're going to seek reflections from two experienced rural generalists on consultations they've had that have shaped the way they consult, along with their consultation pearls and perhaps even some cautionary tales. Joining me is Dr. Lisa White, a dedicated rural generalist anaesthetist from Kapunda in South Australia, where she lives on a working property with her husband and two children. She has a passion for serving rural communities through developing the next generation of rural doctors. Lisa is the Regional Director of Training for Akram in South Australia. Dr. Angela Stratton is a rural generalist working in the Victorian High Country town of Mount Beauty, with a special interest in alpine medicine, working and playing on the ski fields at nearby Falls Creek each winter. Welcome to the podcast, Lisa and Angela.
Thanks for having us, Emily.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I'm just so pleased that both of you have come on today, because I know that our listeners are going to gain a lot from your insights into consultations with a rural context. So just to start off, what do you think about the term difficult consultation?
I think there are certainly consultations that are more challenging, but these are also the consultations that can be most rewarding if done well. Sometimes challenging consultations can be predicted. Sometimes you feel them developing, and sometimes you just suddenly find yourself in the middle of a challenging situation unexpectedly.
Really lovely description. So sometimes they're unpredictable, and sometimes they like emerge in a situation, and sometimes they're more predictable than others. That's a really lovely way to approach it. What do you think, Angela?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary from Lisa. I often think with difficult conversations about why are they difficult, and ultimately it's about making us feel uncomfortable. There's something about that conversation or consultation that we either don't want to have to do, makes us feel awkward. It might be sad. It might be confrontation. But there's something around us that has made us feel uncomfortable, and hence why we call it difficult. And I think sometimes if we can acknowledge what it is about this conversation, if we know in advance that's going to make it difficult, why do we feel uncomfortable? Or even in the heat of the moment, we can take a moment to go, oh, why is this a difficult conversation? Sometimes that can help us deal with it.
And do you think that discomfort is experienced by the practitioner or by the patient or both?
I'd say both. Both, but not necessarily always, and sometimes to differing degrees. I don't know, sometimes I think it's going to be a difficult conversation and it actually turns out that it's not. So perhaps if you're breaking some bad news and the patient's actually was expecting it and takes it better than you thought they did. Or sometimes you think something's going to be quite straightforward and perhaps then it becomes a challenging, angry patient or something like that. So, yes, definitely both, I think, can, but to differing degrees.
And Lisa, let's start with you. How would you describe your own consultation style?
I like to think that my style is very much patient-centred. I hope that by using open questioning, active listening, trying to tailor my pace and language to the patient's needs, that I create a comfortable and supportive environment in which to explore the patient's agendas, their thoughts, beliefs and expectations. I see my role as to provide the patient with options and the right amount of information to make informed decisions about these options so together we can come up with an agreed plan of action.
Do you think that your style is consistent in that approach, Lisa, or do you change it up slightly to suit a particular consultation?
Yeah, I think being flexible and agile is really important, whether that be that you need to meet the patient's individual needs, if perhaps the clinical situation requires a different approach, or whether the environment requires a different approach, whether it be a hospital setting, primary care setting, or pre-hospital setting. So trying to have enough framework to give yourself a starting point, but then have the flexibility to adapt to the situation.
Angela, what do you think about your consultation style?
Yeah, so I once again agree with Lisa that I think flexibility is probably the key most. So I spend about half my time working in an emergency department and the rest of my time in primary care. So naturally I have different consultation skills that I tend to utilize or default to across those different sites. However, the core is still the same. So like Lisa, I'm a big fan of shared decision making, and I even in the emergency department, often when you think someone's choices may be limited, you still can incorporate some shared decision making and involving the patient in their care and the decisions that concern them. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and I actually find that really rewarding. Interestingly, I'm also a bit of a chatter, which means that I struggle to run to time quite a bit. But I think along with that, you sort of attract a different style of patient. I think in general practice, you often will find patients that come to you because they like the way you practice. So I tend to be the sort of person that runs a little bit late, has longer consultations and practices slower medicine. This is in my primary care, just to ensure that I really can explore all those issues with the patient and really get them involved and on board in their care quite a bit. But I do have tendency to run behind sometimes. But in the ED, I can be a bit more concise, but it's amazing how you can still use all those fundamental skills, such as, you know, open questions and exploring the patient's concerns and expectations like that Lisa mentioned, even in a busy emergency department.
But I think, Angela, with that, when you say there's that bit of extra time in shared decision making initially, I think that's a really important investment in time.
Definitely.
And that may well then save the 3 or 4 follow-up appointments that would come if you hadn't taken that time initially to work with the patient and ensure that you're on the same page. So I think it might just be a different distribution of time rather than, not managing the time as well initially.
It's interesting you say that, Lisa, actually, because a patient comes to mind recently that I saw in the emergency department that, you know, sadly was one of the cases of chronic pelvic pain in a young girl with endometriosis who didn't have a lot of, medical literacy around her condition. And previously she'd come in lots of times and been told there's nothing acutely wrong and sent home. But I saw her for the first time and spent an extra, 10 or 15 minutes really just getting down to the core of explaining to her what I think's going on and perhaps different treatment options outside of the emergency department and that, shift to chronic pain and things like that. And by taking that extra time, even in an emergency department, you can actually prevent those repeat presentations to somewhere which actually isn't the most suitable place for a patient. She needs to be in a GP setting and have someone managing her patient from a different framework. So absolutely, a little bit of extra time now can definitely not only save you time, but sometimes save the patient and health system time later on and get them best care.
Couldn't agree more, Angela. And you mentioned that you find the process of shared decision making particularly rewarding. Could you expand on that?
Well, I think we know with shared decision making that it actually, for the most part, gets better outcomes for patients. Particularly in some of the core things we do in primary care, which is preventative medicine or lifestyle medicine, that if the patient's invested in the decisions and the management plan that they've made and they've taken some part in developing that plan, then they're more likely to actually follow through with it. That ultimately gets them better results as a patient and improves their outcome, but it's also really satisfying as a GP then to see the patients getting the results that you've kind of helped them along that journey to get.
Do you feel the same way, Lisa?
Oh, absolutely. I think the days of the doctor providing a management plan and expecting that the patient's going to go away and follow them diligently has long gone. And I think very much it's a positive change that's occurred. Patients have access to so much more information these days and will often come with their own ideas around how they might like to approach their problem or their own concerns about what might be going on, and exploring that existing knowledge and coming to a point where you have a shared understanding of the patient's situation, and then together can develop a plan that will enable best outcomes for the patient is absolutely crucial.
When we're talking about consultation style, specifically in rural medicine, a lot of us adopt colloquialisms to try and help us build rapport at the start of a consultation or when we first meet someone in particular. Is this something that either of you have adopted into your consultation style?
I would say definitely, but maybe I didn't adopt it because it was always there, Emily. I think I'm a country girl from heart, so it tends to be the way that I spoke anyway. And my husband often laughs because he can tell the different, that what he calls my phone voice and my normal voice. And I think once you've been, when I'm in a situation where I'm nice and relaxed and comfortable in my own town with patients that I know well, I think the true Angela comes out, and that just tends to be the way that I speak anyway. And I think is partly the way that I often, you know, just get along with my patients, as I'm quite relaxed in the way that I consult. And I once had a joke with another rural GP who said, you can tell how rural you are by the amount of times you say, yeah, nah, in a consult. So it's just a, so I think it's just the inner part in me. And I probably actually struggle to go the other way when we're in the big city hospitals and have to put on what I would say is a different persona to what my default setting is.
Really interesting reflection. Is it the same for you, Lisa?
Well, I'm a city girl, so I've had to go the other way, Angela. So I certainly think it's important that you're using language that patients can relate to. I think it is important that we also use correct language around medical terminology so that patients are then empowered to understand other things that they may hear from other clinicians or that they may research online. But certainly understanding what's important to a local community and being able to engage in conversations around that is really important. So having married a farmer and moved to a rural setting, I'll never be a local, but I hope that I've got enough vocab now to interact with farmers and talk about what's going on and speak to them in a way that makes them feel like I understand the community.
It sounds like you're using that patient encounter as an opportunity to do some education on health literacy.
I think it goes both ways. So I hope that I'm providing some information on health literacy, but I'm also learning so much from my patients. And I think that happens in every single consultation that I undertake.
I mean, you've both been practicing rural generalists for years now. When you look back over your career so far, do you think that your consultation style has changed over time?
I think we all naturally develop and mature our styles over time. Whether it's consciously or unconsciously. I've certainly been conscious of that process of self-reflection and trying to build and improve my style over time. And I feel like I'm much better at picking up patient cues these days, and have learnt the hard way about a number of approaches that perhaps don't work quite so well or that have not been as well received by patients. And so then trialing different approaches and reflecting on the impact of those. I was very fortunate to have some fantastic supervisors throughout my training, and I learned so much from them and stole liberally from their best bits. So there are parts of my consulting style that is clearly emulating the supervisors that I was so fortunate to be exposed to throughout my training.
In some ways, the change in your style has been organic, but there's also been times where you've deliberately sought out feedback or copied role modelling that you've been exposed to.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary of how many parts of my practice have evolved over time, but specifically around consultation skills.
And what about you, Angela? Who have you sought feedback on to mature and improve your consultation style over the years?
Similarly to Lisa, I think you learn through observation right from the start when you're a medical student and then as a junior doctor going right through. You see people that you want to copy, and then you also see people that you don't want to copy, and you can learn from others. But I consider consultation skills, and although we often think about that meaning communication skills, they're actually a little bit different. And I think it's like building your toolbox. You can't go to everything with a hammer, but that might be, you know, all that you had when you're first graduating. You might have only had one or two tools. And then over time, you start to refine and gather more different tools that you can use at different times in different situations. And you end up with this whole toolbox of things that you can use and adapt to the situation that you've got in front of you. So although you tend to have a natural style that is, you know, your personality and perhaps your preference in the way that you practice, as rural generalists, you need to be able to adapt to the patient in front of you, as Lisa said. And that actually takes deliberate practice. And one of the things I actually also really learned from is I like going and doing mini CEX visits, as a medical educator, because I often even learn, you know, I will learn something in every one of those visits and see different ways that people do things or different tips and tricks. And you're constantly adding to, I don't think you'll ever stop learning in this space. And I often encourage my registrars to actually deliberately practice consultation skills. So try different phrases, try different ways of doing things, and see what happens. See what worked and what didn't work. And why, when you said this phrase to one patient, did you get this response? And then when you use the same phrase with a different patient, did you get a different response? And starting to analyze what you're actually doing, and doing some deliberate practice in that. And I think over time, you'll sharpen your tools and you'll get better and better.
Consultation style and our ability to perform a consultation is a skill that we can develop and practice with time, much like clinical reasoning, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Or physical exam or any of those things, you can refine it, definitely.
I think one of the best sources of feedback for us on our consultation style is our patients. Can either of you think of a specific example where you did or said something that was really beneficial to a patient that you weren't expecting?
I think for me it actually probably came from the situation that Angela was describing of when I first started observing other people's practices as part of external clinical visits. And I think up until that point, as a young female GP new to my town, I was seeing a lot of other young women with a variety of complaints, but specifically in this example, you know, those presenting with irritable bowel syndrome type issues. And I thought I was providing quite good practice. I'd take a thorough history, do a thorough examination, order some investigations, refer them off. I thought I was doing quite a good job. And then sat and watched others undertaking the same consultation and could see that from watching junior doctors who were being very diligent and asking all the questions and working through and making sure they're excluding serious causes, that often that was actually increasing patients' anxieties. And it caused me to sort of reflect on what I was doing and went back to my own practice and started to really analyse how I was structuring these consultations and took an approach that was very much around providing reassurance to patients about, you know, positive changes they could make to improve their situation, and move from having patients who worked through a clinical journey that they excluded a serious disease but never really resolved the underlying issues, to having patients that were actively engaged in their care, and together we started to move through some of the concerns that they had and the underlying reasons for their symptoms and the changes they could make within lifestyle and diet and other things, and noticed that suddenly these patients were actually getting better. And I think for me that was that first moment when I realised the power of the consultation interaction that we have and how we can make small changes in our own practice to really positively impact patient outcome.
Really encouraging story. And I think it gets to the heart of primary care and general practice, where you're treating the whole person and going on a journey with them. So, Angela, do you have any specific examples about interaction with the patient where something beneficial happened that you weren't expecting?
Similarly to Lisa, I guess I can't necessarily say one specific example, because I think it becomes a more of a general thing that really defaults down to really listening to patients. I'm a big believer in the ask before tell philosophy in consultations. And I think sometimes with complex or difficult to explain medical symptoms, so these are the ones where people, you know, they come in with fatigue or they come in with aches and pains, and they often get dismissed, or, you know, they may have seen seven or eight doctors beforehand, or they finally end up in seeing you and they're kind of exasperated and they've had lots of different tests and things done. And really sitting and listening to, not necessarily taking that history of what is your fatigue and how long has it been there, but actually the impact that these symptoms are having on that person. And you may not necessarily be able to give them a diagnosis, or in fact, sometimes I might have been the first person to actually say, look, I think this is chronic fatigue syndrome, and actually giving a label to their diagnosis can sometimes be very empowering. But even if you can't, just switching the focus from that, you know, asking questions to find a diagnosis to actually just thinking about impact and function can be very powerful for patients and very meaningful. And often they'll come back to me, you know, several consultations down the track, and they'll say something to say, you're the first person who's truly listened or who really understood what it is that this is, you know, what kind of impact this is having on me. So I just can't, you can't underestimate the power of listening. I think sometimes it's not always about our knowledge or what we can diagnose, but just actually understanding the patient and their perspective and how this illness might be impacting them.
It sounds like just validating the patient experience in those sorts of consultations is in itself therapeutic.
Definitely. Yeah.
So we've talked about consultations where the styles and techniques in our approach to them have gone really well and led to benefits for the yeah. patients that we're treating. Could we move now to talking about consultations you've been a part of where on reflection you'd do something differently next time if you're in the same situation?
I think my answer is going to be fairly stereotypical here, in that I think it, early consulting, for me, it was around not being firm enough with boundaries early on, particularly around specific, you know, challenging patient relationships around chronic pain, opioid-seeking behaviour, et cetera. I think that's a very common challenge that doctors have when they first move into primary care or into practice in general. Yeah. And I think it took me a long time to realise that putting those boundaries in place was actually about achieving better patient outcomes, and that was perhaps something that I could do to assist patients when they weren't able to do that for themselves. And so that, I think it's just such a common issue, and I think that it takes time to develop those skills. But again, asking for feedback, looking at those around you, seeing when you've seen it go well with more senior doctors or times that you've seen it go badly, and then trying to incorporate that to your practice is so important.
That's a really good one, Lisa. I think I'm still learning that about boundaries now. I think it's always something we have to remind ourselves of. With me, Emily, I think with maturity of practice and of life, I've definitely become less judgmental. I think when you're early on in your career, it's very easy to go, oh, why is this person with COPD still smoking? And, you know, you have these judgments that even if you don't say them in a consultation, you still carry those, and that can definitely come across in perhaps body language or the way you phrase things, you know, why didn't you come in earlier? Or, you know, those things that can actually create patient shame or, you know, negatively impact a consultation without you realizing it. As over time, I tend to just throw judgment out the window now, and I have a genuine belief that patients are doing the best that they can, and very rarely would you ever have someone who's deliberately sabotaging their own health. You know, that everybody is just surviving in the way that they can, and they prioritize their health in different ways depending on what else is going on in their lifestyle. So I think, you know, how would I now consult differently? Well, I really just leave the judgment at the door now, and it is about the patient that I've got in front of me, and genuinely seeing them from the perspective that they're doing the best that they can, and it's my job to be able to provide whatever advice or support I can in the moment and in the situation that they're in. So I think I've definitely changed in that perspective over the years.
Thanks so much for sharing that bit of wisdom. I think between the two of you, your advice to registrars so far is to have boundaries and also to be open-minded, to avoid shaming your patient and be judgmental. Have you got any other pearls that you'd like to share while you're on the podcast?
I think one of the key questions and the pitfalls that I've certainly fallen into and I see others falling into is launching into detailed and confident explanations of what will definitely fix a problem, only to find out that patients have already done exactly that with no effect. And so one of my favourite questions is, you know, what have you done so far? So what have you already done to try and resolve this yourself, and then tailor my advice to build on that or scaffold onto what they've already done. I think asking patients what they think is going on is so valuable, but it does need to be prefaced. So just saying to patients, well, what do you think's happening? We'll sometimes receive that abrupt response of, well, you're the doctor, aren't you going to tell me, or something to that effect. So I'll tend to preface it with, I've got some ideas in my head about what might be going on. You've clearly been thinking about this for a while, or you've clearly been experiencing this for a while. I'm keen to understand what you might be thinking about, to try and explore some of those expectations and some of the ideas that patients bring to the consultation, so that you can then discuss them openly and come to a joint understanding of what's going on and how to move forward.
Oh, that's just gold, Lisa. Angela, I'm sure you've got some to add.
Yeah, well, I was similarly going to say that the ask before tell concept, which is what Lisa kind so beautifully gave that example then, always finding out what the patient's perspective or view or understanding is before you launch in. Not only is it, you know, as Lisa said, not wanting to lecture them on something they already know about, but it actually also saves a lot of talking from sustainability and your own exhaustion levels by the end of the day as well, to let the patient do the most of the talking. One of the things that we see, what I see happen quite often still, particularly in the hospital setting, is that jumping into the closed or leading questions. And I just encourage all registrars to really reflect on trying to keep the consultation questions as open as possible for as long as possible. And you can even do this in emergency department, saying things like, tell me more, or tell me more about that, or that's interesting, I'd like to hear more, and just keeping that patient talking, and you'll find that you'll get a much richer history out of the patient that way. Yet often we know we shouldn't do it, but we default to those closed questions so quickly. So I'd really encourage people, even in an ED setting, to still stay as open as possible. I think also remembering to paraphrase and summarise what you've heard from the patient is really powerful and shows that listening and understanding again. And you can do it at multiple times through the consult. So what I hear you say is, or my understanding is, you know, is that correct? And checking in with the patient to make sure that what you think's going on, or what you've heard actually is what the patient's meant to tell you. And then I guess my final pearl at the end is one of my favourites, which I call your get out of jail free card, which is there anything I haven't asked that you'd like to tell me? And therefore, if you have defaulted to your closed questions too quickly or there's some key piece of information, it does give you that opportunity for the patient to just give you one last summary of something that they might have forgotten. I have tried the, is there anything I've missed? But once again, like Lisa said earlier, that comes, well, what do you mean you've missed? That sort of has a negative feel to it sometimes. But is there, you know, anything I haven't asked that you'd like to tell me? And they often come out with something that can be quite important. So, yeah, there, I guess, my key points.
Oh, thanks, Angela. I actually have a similar get out of jail free card question that I put at the end of my histories, and that is there anything else you think I should know?
Yes, great.
So, yeah, very similar. Because, yeah, like you said, sometimes there is, and you just haven't been able to ask the right questions to give them the space to talk about it. So an open-ended question like that at the end of your history could just reveal something really critical to that whole consultation. All right. Well, I think that we've shared a lot of wisdom there about consultation, a consultation style from both of your years of experience as rural generalists. Just to reflect in our conversation, we've spoken about that challenging consultations sometimes are predictable, but sometimes are not. They're often difficult because they make us feel uncomfortable as well as the patient. Flexibility in your consultation approach is really helpful. And happily, your consultation style can continue to mature and improve over time, especially if you have the opportunity to witness role modelling amongst your peers, colleagues and supervisors, and also through seeking deliberate feedback from your clinical network and your patients. Having a really impactful consultation style and validating your patient's journey and feelings can be therapeutic in and of itself. And it's important to have boundaries when we're consulting with patients to protect ourselves and for them as well. We want to be open-minded, avoid shaming our patients and be judgmental. And there's a few questions that we can ask as part of our histories to reveal hidden agendas and information about our patient that will change their journey in our management. Well, thank you so much, Lisa and Angela, for your time on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thanks for having us.
Wonderful. Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you. And cut.